This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. The talk in Washington is still all about the brink. Give me more specifics on spending cuts, say the Republicans in Washington, D.C., or take it or leave it on the tax cuts, say some Democrats.
I remain the most optimistic person in this town, but we've got some serious differences.
Speaker John Boehner there. Is there an argument over who is the most optimistic person in Washington, D.C.? There may be a bigger competition over who is the most pessimistic person in town this week. Lots of lawmakers making dire predictions in the absence of a real nuts and bolts deal. Speaker Boehner trying out some of his lowball pessimism after a phone call with the president this week.
His plan does not fulfill his promise to bring a balanced approach to solving this problem. It's mainly tax hikes. And his plan does not begin to solve our debt crisis.
America has faced a serious debt crisis many, many times in its past. In all of those periods, a serious national emergency pulled politicians together to pay bills everybody came to agree were critical. Simon Johnson is a professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management and author of the new book White House Burning. It refers to the burning of the White House back in the War of 1812, which finally got Presidents Madison and Jefferson to find consensus on a staggering national debt back then.
There's plenty of historical parallels and plenty of lessons that we can draw from history in terms of how to manage the debt and manage it in a responsible way without harming the economy. There's also some new territory here because all the previous big run-ups, five previous big run-ups in debt in U.S. history, were all about wars or other forms of national emergency, including independence, War of 1812, Civil War, World War I, World War II. The difference here is we have an aging population, aging society. We just had a massive financial crisis, and it's the compounding of those elements, not an international emergency. Yeah, the foreign wars, Afghanistan and Iraq were expensive, but that's not what's really propelled us to this difficult fiscal moment. It's much more about domestic decisions and difficulties around deciding about who's going to pay what in and who's going to get what out of our fiscal federal system.
Are you saying, given our American political system and history, that we've generally had a better track record coming to agreement on paying for things like wars and national emergencies than we seem to be having about paying for the aging population, and what level of benefits should we expect from our government?
Yes. Look, we've had a great track record, one of the best track records in the world, around handling national emergencies, handling the public finances that in a responsible way, using debt, issuing debt in order to get through the emergency, and then bringing that debt down relative to the size of the economy, not in a precipitate manner, but in a responsible, managed manner subsequently. The difficulties we have today are, I think, in part because the problems are somewhat more abstract. It's not that we've just been attacked by Japan and we're also going to war with Germany. It's much more that we had a massive financial crisis. The banks blew themselves up, did enormous damage to the economy, pushed us into a deep recession. That drove up the debt. And this is the moment when we started to think a little bit more seriously about the aging of the population, particularly looking at the implications of not having controlled healthcare costs. You look out 10, 20, 30 years, it's healthcare that eats not just the budget, it eats the economy. And so we're having this conversation. It's abstract. There's a lot of things coming together. The politicians have not done a great job in terms of unpackaging and explaining it to us. So it's become very, very emotional. This is a harder conversation than after World War II or after World War I.
You know, one of the things that your book states and really kind of scares me in a way is that this whole fiscal cliff rhetoric delivers the illusion of something tangible. But in fact, this emotional debate is still about something that is fundamentally abstract. It's just the politicians are getting a lot of benefit from making it seem like, you know, there's this railroad train headed for all of our heads.
Yes, the politicians are certainly enjoying, in a bizarre way, the moment. They're getting a lot of attention and they're getting their messages across. The problem is that they're not really confronting the deeper underlying issues, the instability of the financial system, the way the banks contributed to the big run-up in public debt. That's not on anybody's agenda. Bringing healthcare costs seriously under control, We're sort of at a stalemate on that critical issue, and neither side really wants to bring that into the open. So I think there will be a resolution of the fiscal cliff. We'll probably go over the cliff and then do a deal soon afterwards. But will we really confront our deeper underlying weaknesses around public finance? No, I don't think we will. Not as long as the government can borrow as much as it can and as cheaply as it can.
I'm wondering if this is a little bit like what happened in the lead up to the financial crisis, where a lot of people saw what was coming, but there wasn't real agreement about what to do about it. And so the banks and the financial sector just allowed itself to go over the brink. Are we looking at this as essentially a kind of public sector bubble that's eventually going to burst, and we're not going to resolve our differences in time for the bubble to burst? And so that's really what the fiscal cliff is?
Well, it's bigger than the fiscal cliff. The fiscal cliff is just a warm-up to the main act. I think the parallel you suggest has some merit, in particular that no one wants to have the difficult conversation. And everyone says, yes, yes, there's some weaknesses here, but surely we can go on for a long time before those catch up with us. And of course, what we've learned from the crisis of 2007 to 2008, what we've seen in Europe recently, what we've seen in actually crises throughout history, is you never know when the difficulties are going to hit you. And when they hit you, if you're not prepared, you can be overwhelmed. And I think that's what bothers me, is that very, very few people, both on the left and on the right, really want to have the difficult conversation, let alone get close to any kind of sensible resolution.
So then, looking at the history that you describe in this book, White House Burning, would you rather be President Obama right now or the president who was in the White House that was burning after the War of 1812 and had all of those debts to deal with?
Yeah, that was James Madison, and that was a very bad moment for him personally and for the country. The good thing, though, about Madison, the great story from the Madison-Jefferson side of American politics, is that they changed their mind. The War of 1812 was a wake-up call. They realized that they had underfunded the government. They realized that they had mismanaged the whole issue of public debt, and they changed their policies going forward and consequently helped to put the United States on a much sounder footing that lasted not only through the 19th century, it lasted well into the 20th century. So the encouraging lesson from that experience is that we can change the consensus, we can change our policies, and this country was built on a history of fiscal responsibility. I think President Obama could move us back towards that tradition. It's obviously not only up to him. Other politicians have to move as well. But he has a great opportunity in his second term to move us in a sensible, responsible way. It's not about precipitating austerity, precipitating a deep recession. It's about changing the consensus around how we manage our public finances.
Simon Johnson, professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management and author of White House Burning. He spoke with us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thank you, Simon.
Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.